Good morning, New Covenant. This is Kevin Hamilton, and I'm glad to be back teaching with you in my first Sunday of the new year, 2021. Many of us probably know today's passage of the calling of the young boy, the young prophet Samuel. I've always loved this story of God calling someone, of them listening, of them not even knowing what they're hearing. As a young boy, I remember sleeping at night thinking, might I hear such a voice? I listened. And it's just so striking to imagine hearing the voice of the very Lord in your sleep, in your room, not once, but three times. It's a powerful, embodied thing. I remember hoping that I would have an opportunity to walk down the hall and ask my parents if they thought that's what I was hearing. This was the passage that I asked my friend and then pastor Tim to read to my son Simon when he was less than 2 months old and still in the hospital, though the rest of us were home and struggling with some health matters we didn't fully understand. Tim came to sit with Simon and me and asked if there was a passage he could read for us, and today's passage from Samuel is the one that came to mind for me at the time. I still pray for my sons to hear such a call from the Lord, as I pray to hear one too. We all hope for such a call, I think, that kind of direction from the Lord, the voice in our ear. We hope and pray that we'll be able to hear it when it comes, but reading the passage today, in light of where we are at this moment, I'm not sure that I'm really supposed to read myself into Samuel's side of the story. I think I'm probably supposed to read myself as on Eli's side of the story. Today, on the weekend we celebrate the gifts, service, and sacrifice of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., I have to identify Dr. King as in Samuel's position here. The prophet through which God speaks to a family in power whose sin has overtaken them. And I have to see myself and all of white America as not with Samuel, but with Eli's corrupt household. So let me say a little more about this and invite you to read it that way with me today, in hopes of discerning the future that awaits, the sinful house that many of us still inhabit. How did Dr. King come to be the one to deliver God's news of judgment, as Samuel did? What prepared him for that? What was the sin of Eli's house? What has Dr. King been telling us, even beyond his murder, to which we should respond the way Eli did to God through Samuel? Let's lean into this story, into some of Dr. King's teachings today. But first, let's set the stage by remembering where this account falls within the Hebrew Scriptures. This origin story of one of Israel's greatest prophets and heroes takes place before the time of the kings, but after the time of Moses. We spent some time in this season of the Hebrew story before. It's one I really like. It's a strange time in which the tribes are living dispersed across the hills of Palestine without a clear center of government or clear presence in the land. It's the time of the judges. They are a marginal people, a diaspora, an immigrant people whose identity is on the brink of being lost to assimilation. And though they've arrived at the promised land, they don't yet have a lot to show for it. So at this time, the time of this passage, they continue to wait, to cling to the order of living that their Lord gave them in the desert, the cycles of prayer and sacrifice that keep them together, keep the vulnerable cared for, and therefore keep them all in the Lord's presence. In that context, the book of 1 Samuel first introduces us to two families, that of Eli and that of Elkanah. Eli's family comes from the priestly lineage, descendants of Levi and Aaron. Elkanah's family are from the Hebrew tribe of Ephraim. Eli's family of priests by tradition cannot own land, but hold prestigious positions, perhaps the most prestigious positions in the Hebrew people, as caretakers of the temple rites. They're cared for by law and represent as close as one can get to an upper class for the Hebrews at the time. As part of the tribe of Ephraim, on the other hand, Elkanah's family were less well off. But maybe they were kind of middle class. They did benefit from the fact that of all the places in Palestine, the holy places to which all the Hebrews journeyed to make their offerings and stay connected to the Lord were in Ephraim's part of the hills. So some traditions and accounts find the families of Ephraim pretty well off, and we can imagine the ways they might benefit at least from others who need to pass through their spaces to get to the obligatory destination of the temple and worship. But still, no matter the social status of a family, throughout history, we can always find the women of the family suffering, sadly, at the bottom. And this story is no exception. The book of 1 Samuel opens by shining a light on Hannah, one of Elkanah's two wives. And we see here a picture of Elkanah's family as exceedingly faithful to the Lord, and that they always visit the holy places at the appointed times, always bring their offerings. The two families of Eli and Elkanah know each other in this context. A family of priests who come to know this neighbor family through their regular appearance at the holy place and holy ceremonies. And it's there, in that space of familiarity and routine, that we see Hannah suffering. She shows up to these regular celebrations bereft and uncertain, as she has no children by Elkanah. How is she to be part of the Lord's promise to the people if she's not part of that stream? Who will take care of her when she's in need? Hannah is living precariously, alone, at the fringes of her social position. And Eli the priest sees her there through the eyes of God as she prays so hard, cries so hard, displays her suffering so greatly. But he doesn't even recognize God there at first. We see in the story that she has cried out to the Lord so long in her suffering that she has lost her voice. Eli sees her simply moving her lips in prayer without a voice and mistakes her for drunk. Still, he approaches her and learns that she has made a promise to God that if a son comes to her at last, she would dedicate him to the priesthood, and she shares that with him. And he receives it and blesses it, almost despite himself. Meanwhile, the story thickens, the plot thickens here. We also learn that as Hannah suffers within her family, the family itself suffers under the hand of Eli's family. For Eli's sons, we learn, abuse their position of privilege and power by stealing from those who come to worship and honor their commitments to the Lord. At the time, faithful celebrants of the holy sacrifices brought their precious meat to offer God. And the law called for them to offer that meat and then burn off the fat on the altar, the richest part, as a fragrant offering, a gesture towards plenty, before taking part of the rest of the meat themselves to eat as sustenance. The priests, by law, are to partake in this as well, of that meat, providing the priests, no doubt, with some of their only source of sustenance, as they cannot own land to raise their own. But we learn from 1 Samuel that Eli's sons, as priests looking after this process, instead would take the meat from the holy altar before it was even finished cooking, or sometimes even demand the raw meat from the celebrants before it even started cooking, and keep it for themselves. This was theft, and grave on multiple levels. It steals from the Lord according to the law. It robs the celebrants of their chance to keep right with the Lord and offer their prayers. And it takes food from the celebrants' own mouths. In this light, the sources of Hannah's misery are all the more evident. Nearly without status within her family itself is suffering under a ruling class that steals from them. And what's more, she fears that even her prayers for deliverance may not be reaching the Lord. The smells are not there, the fat's not even burning, and she's probably hungry herself. We know that the priests are stealing food from her, and we even see there in the scriptures that when Eli finally and mercifully speaks with her to assure her that the Lord has heard her prayers, one of the first things she does is go away and eat. All of this gives me some greater context for her song, the beautiful poem in chapter 2 of 1 Samuel, where, with young Samuel in hand, returning to the temple to fulfill her promise, she sings. She sings to the Lord. Before she leaves to go home, and in, surely, in young Samuel's presence, she sings these beautiful lines. The bows of the warriors are broken, but those who stumbled are armed with strength. Those who were full hire themselves out for food, but those who were hungry are hungry no more. She who was barren has borne 7 children, but she who has had many sons pines away. He raises the poor from the dust and lifts the needy from the ash heap. He seats them with princes and has them inherit a throne of honor. For the foundations of the earth are the Lord's. On them he has set the world. He will guard the feet of his faithful servants, but the wicked will be silenced in the place of darkness. Hannah sings, "It is not by strength that one prevails. Those who oppose the Lord will be broken. The Most High will thunder from heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth." In the story of Samuel hearing God's call in the night that we heard today already, and finally answering, I have to think that his mother Hannah plays as much a role in his preparation and response as does his mentor Eli. Imagine that formative moment as young Samuel stood there, handed off from his mother to a new family that he'd likely heard maligned as an enemy of the household. And here she is singing in their very presence about their downfall. That is some strength in God right there. Some confidence in God's order. And seeing and hearing about that kind of God, it's a God I'd want to listen for as a kid. And so we get to today's reading, where a time later, Samuel hears God's voice directly, not just through his mother, as in this earlier time, and then begins his ministry of truth and action. It's easy for me to forget that his first task then in this story, the message he's actually called to deliver in this story, is one of judgment on the family of Eli, the family that is raising him, the family corrupted by power through theft from others and from the Lord. I'll read this piece again so it's fresh for us. "And the Lord said to Samuel, 'See, I'm about to do something in Israel that will make the ears of everyone who hears about it tingle. At that time, I will carry out against Eli everything I spoke against his family from beginning to end. For I told him that I would judge his family forever because of the sin he knew about. His sons blasphemed God, and he failed to restrain them. Therefore, I swore to the house of Eli, the guilt of Eli's house will never be atoned for by a sacrifice or offering.' Samuel lay down until morning and then opened the doors of the house of the Lord. He was afraid to tell Eli this vision. But Eli called him and said, 'Samuel, my son.' Samuel answered, 'Here I am.' 'What was it he said to you?' Eli asked. 'Don't hide it from me. May God deal with you, be it ever so severely, if you hide from me anything God told you.' So Samuel told him everything, hiding nothing from him. And Eli said, 'He is the Lord. Let him do what is good in his eyes.'" By the story's account, Eli's role in the evil of his family is indirect. It is his sons, we learn, are the main actors, yet the judgment comes in the whole family. And importantly, the message of judgment comes from among those they oppress. It's a tribute to Eli and an example that he listens and accepts, but why couldn't he hear it from the Lord himself? How many times had the Lord tried to tell Eli what was wrong? Wasn't it written as plain as day? In the law, in their own stories. I take from the story that when we are deep within sin, and generational sin in this case, it makes us deaf to the Lord. We cannot hear God. We have to hear judgment from those we have wronged. This seems part of the order of things, and hopefully we will listen. Meanwhile, God is preparing those wronged to deliver just such a message. Samuel the prophet doesn't come from just anywhere, a mythical voice in the wilderness. He's coming from the faithful strength of his own mother, Hannah, in her suffering, in the context of a family that regularly sought God's presence, even knowing the evil they'd face there. This is what prepared him to be the sort of prophet he would be, a boy who listens. I think today of Dr. King's own preparation for ministry and the witness of his own mother, Alberta Williams King. How many times did young Dr. King hear his own mother singing in the midst of suffering, just as Samuel heard his own mother singing? She was, after all, Alberta Williams King, a leader of song, an organ player in the church, As is often true of history, we don't hear a lot about her role, this strong woman of faith, but we know that there she was, at the organ of Ebenezer Baptist Church. And we know that she lost not one son but two to systemic oppression. And tragically, we know that she herself died at the organ, shot by a man who was most certainly poisoned by this country's history of hate. Dr. King's mother suffered, and he grew up in the midst of a woman who was faithful to God in that suffering. On this weekend, when we celebrate and learn from Dr. King, I welcome how 1 Samuel places Hannah's song next to the message young Samuel delivered to Eli. We get both the vision of the work completed, as Hannah experienced it, even in the midst of suffering, with the structures of oppression still firmly in place, and we get the definitive message of judgment on specific wrongs against the people who are keeping those structures in place. In 1 Samuel, we get both the voice of a great prophet and the voices of those around him, from whom he drew strength and wisdom. In Eli's family, corruption and theft from the poor was a family business, just as in Hannah's family, dependence on God and a vision of God's victory was a family business. It takes more than one oligarch to oppress, and it takes more than one prophet to liberate. Too often, white America reads Dr. King on a weekend like this for examples of the sort of witness and celebration Hannah offers without also listening to the sort of judgment that God offers through young Samuel. Dr. King, drawing from the traditions and support of his community and a close-up view to suffering like we can't imagine, offered both. We've already heard today, through Jeff Trask's witness, an example from Hannah's tradition of witness to God's victory. But let's make sure today, especially for those of us whose ancestors stole, as Eli's family did, that we also hear from Dr. King's proclamations in the tradition of young Samuel, faithfully delivering God's message of judgment. Let me share a bit about that tradition before we conclude. In 1964, Dr. King published his book, Why We Can't Wait, a larger meditation on the struggle thus far that introduced many people to his most famous letter, the epistle, Letter from a Birmingham Jail. The book's last chapter, titled The Days to Come, addresses the sin of what King calls gradualism, an approach to righting wrongs against black peoples that left much of the work of achieving equality still on their shoulders. I'll explain here in some of my own words. In the name of equal rights, we might integrate schools. We might level the playing field, point to the chair we've made at the table for our black brothers and sisters. See, we might say, in the name of gradualism, everyone is equal. I don't see color like my forebears did. Everyone's got an equal chance now. We might say, look, we've had a black president. Now we have a black vice president. We've had a black head football coach. We have a black university chancellor. Everyone has a chance in today's America. Meanwhile, so many of our black brothers and sisters are still suffering from the generational sin of exploitation and disinvestment. As we've heard about before in some of our teachings in the last few months, my white parents and grandparents got access, for example, to government-subsidized home loans, while my black brothers' parents were forbidden from even living in certain neighborhoods by explicit covenants or implicit biased real estate practices. I'm here in the House of Eli. I have to face that, still benefiting from the meat my forebears stole from the offering of others, while my brothers and sisters in the House of Ephraim, of Hannah, are still suffering from those they lost, the children they didn't have or who were stolen, the lack of opportunity to even build equity to give from to the Lord. For me to point to the work is done, to equality is achieved through the laws passed, even those laws passed as a result of Dr. King's great work, is to continue living in my corrupt house, deaf to the Lord. As Dr. King says, in that last chapter of his great book, when I describe the work as complete and then expect my black brothers and sisters to rise up and do the rest, I might as well be asking them to buy their own families out of slavery as so many did years ago. Here's a quote from Dr. King in the tradition of Samuel's judgment. The Negro today is not struggling for some abstract, vague rights, but for concrete and prompt improvement in his way of life. What will it profit him to be able to send his children to an integrated school if the family income is insufficient to buy them school clothes? What will he gain by being permitted to move to an integrated neighborhood if he cannot afford to do so because he's unemployed or has a low-paying job with no future? Dr. King goes on, "The struggle for rights is, at bottom, a struggle for opportunities." In asking for something special, the Negro is not seeking charity. He does not want to languish on welfare rolls any more than the next man. With equal opportunity must come the practical, realistic aid which will equip him to seize it. Giving a pair of shoes to a man who has not learned to walk is a cruel jest. Dr. King calls for new laws to remove the ways that continue to give the rich an advantage over the poor, the empowered over the exploited. I see a basis for reparation in his argument, for material redistribution of wealth, but also, and importantly, for our Sunday of worship and teaching and humble learning today. Dr. King calls for these changes, as God did through Samuel, in terms of atonement. He writes, "We will make progress if we accept the fact that 400 years of sinning cannot be canceled out in 4 minutes of atonement. Neither can we allow the guilty to tailor their atonement in such a manner as to visit another 4 seconds of deliberate hurt upon the victim." In recent months, since the murder of George Floyd, there's been a lot more talk, thankfully, in this church and others about how to atone for our generational sins. But let us not forget how easy it is for us as the comfortable people, the people in power, to seek atonement on our terms. We must be vigilant about this, learning from the example of Eli, a man who, like so many Christians in America, was right enough with the Lord to know that it was the Lord's voice young Samuel heard. But he wasn't right enough to undo and remove the corruption his own family kept in place. There are many followers of Jesus in this nation. They recognize God, know God is there, long to hear from God. But as they struggle to hear a word, are they ready to hear from those to whom God speaks, exploited at their very feet? What a tragic picture the story of Eli offers, there near the end of a family's line of promise, as God delivers to him the news that in fact there will be no atoning for his family in sacrifice and offering, that his offspring will die and that his line will end. At least, he is ready to say to Samuel, recognizing that God is speaking to the boy, "Do not hide it from me." And on hearing the word of judgment, at least Eli is willing to answer, there at the tragic end of things, "He is the Lord. Let him do what is good in his eyes." Every year, this nation celebrates Dr. King, with predominantly white churches across this nation even celebrating his message. May this nation finally, humbly, prayerfully, also hear and act on the judgment present throughout Dr. King's prophecy, and not only on his witness to God's deliverance. I praise God that we have both the tradition of Hannah and the tradition of Samuel to listen to and learn from. But if in Hannah's joy we see hope of deliverance from our own sin, let us first attend to and turn from the ways in which we are responsible for the very darkness from which the strong, faithful Hannahs of this world seek deliverance. May God have mercy on us. May we listen and finally hear God's voice. But most importantly, may we hear from those to whom God is speaking all around us, whom we have exploited, and to whom we owe so much in repair and restoration. Let us go to communion with that repentance in mind. Amen.